Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to see everyone. Happy spring. Beautiful day out there. So today's topic is Bodhidharma, what do the legends tell us? So as you know, teachers here often talk about the Zen ancestors. And the reason we do that is that learning about the Zen ancestors can help us to do our practice here and now. And so today I'm talking about Bodhidharma, who was born about 1,500 years ago, and he was the first person in our lineage in China. And this supposedly unbroken lineage starts with, well, a few Buddhas before Shakyamuni Buddha, then Shakyamuni Buddha, then the Indian ancestors, Chinese ancestors, Japanese ancestors, Dainin Katagiri, who founded this temple. And this topic, Bodhidharma, is the subject of our morning study group, which I'm leading right now. Morning study group's a lot of fun. I encourage you to check one out at some point. It's just a discussion. We rely on the group wisdom. This morning, I'm going to be expanding on some comments that I made at the morning study group. And some of this is a little detailed, maybe a little arcane, and some of it is introductory. It's the nature of Dharma talks that you need to try to write a talk that will appeal to people who are hearing their very first Dharma talk, as well as people who have been hearing Dharma talks in this room for 20, 30, or 40 years. And we do have people that fit that description. So I hope that if you're new, you'll be patient with the stuff that's rather detailed, and if you've been here a long time, you'll be patient with the introductory stuff. So, in morning study group, we're focusing on Bodhidharma's writings, or at least those that are attributed to him, because we really don't know anything for certain about Bodhidharma. But we're using this book, The Zen Teaching of Bodhidharma, translated by Red Pine. And we recently had a talk on a Tuesday evening by Matt, which was about Bodhidharma, and I think that also focused on his writings. But today, I would like to talk not so much about the writings, but more about the symbolism, the legends, the stories, the myths that have grown up around him. Because I think this is an opportunity to examine the spirit of Zen as it's been handed down to us, and also to take kind of a critical look at some aspects of our traditional Zen practice. Because I think we have to look critically at our own history if we're going to go forward with integrity. So we'll see if we can bring this alive. First, I'd like to start with some of the facts. So Bodhidharma is the 28th person in our lineage, 27th after the Buddha, first person of our lineage in China, first person in our lineage to be known as a Zen person. And in China, it's called Chan, not Zen, but I'm going to use the term Zen because it's more familiar. So you may be familiar with Bodhidharma. I hung a banner with this picture over here, and I'm afraid you can't all see it, and those people listening online can't see it. So I'll just describe it a little bit. It's a black and white drawing of this big guy kind of leaning into you, with kind of a scowl, very long earlobes, bulging eyes, kind of a formidable looking character, kind of a little bit scary. Yeah, there he is. There he is. I'll talk a little later about why his eyes look like that. But first I have to say a little bit about his Zen to get us oriented here. So, best way to talk about his brand of Zen is to quote four lines that he's probably most famous for. Notwithstanding that these four lines were probably written much later by Nan Chuan, but we're talking about the legend and the stories, so that's okay. So here are the lines. This is about what Zen is. A special transmission outside the teachings, not relying upon words and letters, pointing directly at the human mind, seeing one's own nature, and becoming a Buddha. So, a special transmission outside the teachings. Zen is something that goes from teacher to student. It's a kind of demonstration of a way of being. It has to be person to person, live. Not relying upon words and letters. You can't get it from books. Books may be helpful, but you can't get it from books. And in the writings attributed to him, he rails repeatedly against doctrine and ritual. To the extent you get the idea that the monks he knew, the monks of his time, must have been really focused on stuff that took them away from their direct experience, that they were focused on reading the books and doing the rituals, but that there was really something missing there. There was something really kind of hollow about their practice. Pointing directly at the human mind. You can only do this by going within, by becoming familiar with your own mind, by doing the practice. Seeing one's nature and becoming a Buddha. You can't become a Buddha by listening to someone else's experience. You have to have the experience yourself. So Bodhidharma did use doctrines to some extent, even though he railed against them. But I think he used them in aid of getting to that direct experience. They didn't replace getting to that direct experience. And a number of scholars say that he relied heavily on the Lankavatara Sutra. Red Pine disputes that. But in any case, in that sutra, the Buddha said, "If someone says a Buddha's teaching is dependent on language, they are mistaken. Such a teaching transcends language. Therefore, neither I nor any other Buddha or Bodhisattva utters a single word." And this recalls for us the first Zen talk, what is said to be the first Zen talk, when the Buddha was sitting in front of many, many monks waiting to hear him speak, and he simply held up a flower and he said nothing at all. So, for your real Dharma talk, go outside today, take a walk, the lake is right there, allow your eyes to fall upon something, allow it to come to you, don't pick out something to look at it, and there's your Dharma talk. So, he emphasized transmission outside the teachings. He also practiced a new form of meditation, it is believed, but we're not totally sure what that new form of meditation was. Heinrich de Meulen, in his book Zen Buddhism, A History, says it's impossible to say how it differed from Indian dhyana meditation. Now, we do know that Indian dhyana meditation had 8 stages, and that Zen, at least eventually, had none. There are no stages in Zen meditation. There is no step ladder Zen. You're either here or you're not. Red Pine says in his introduction in this book of Bodhidharma's writings that Zen is not a purification of the mind or a stage on the way to Buddhahood. So Zen is just this. So Bodhidharma probably rejected all stages of meditation. Another clue as to what his meditation was like, Red Pine says in Zen Baggage that before Bodhidharma, people practiced meditation or wisdom, wisdom being an understanding of emptiness. Zen, he says, involves doing both simultaneously. Red Pine says wisdom without meditation is pie in the sky Zen. Meditation without wisdom is dead tree Zen. So I can imagine a kind of meditation that's informed by a deep intuitive understanding of emptiness. So my conclusion is that maybe Bodhidharma was not so novel when compared to all the teachers of the time, but he tends to get a lot of credit for bringing Zen to China. But it's the legends, I think, that are really significant, and they help to transmit the essence of Zen, as we'll see. So I'm going to talk a little bit about his life. First question is, did he exist? There is quite a lot of debate about this. No one is certain. Andy Ferguson said in Tracking Bodhidharma that most of his story comes from accounts that were written after he lived. In some cases, long after he lived. In some cases, I think centuries after he lived. Some scholars say he did not exist. Andy Ferguson says he most definitely existed. And I think that's probably true. There are historical records. I don't think they're quite contemporary, but they do talk about this foreigner, Bodhidharma, showing up in certain places at certain times. And one source says that for Zen, Zen itself, whether he actually existed doesn't matter. It's the authenticity of his experience that really matters. What's important here is the living truth, not dry documents and history and dates and all of that stuff. And I agree. I think that our aim here is not to be historians, but to take the spiritual path, to find out how that great mystery of life and death can inform our daily actions. So I'll tell the story. And some of it may be true, and some of it surely is not true. He was born around 440 in southern India. He was the third son of a king. He converted to Buddhism. His teacher was Prajñātara, who was a well-known teacher. And Prajñātara wanted him to go to China to teach. So he undertook a sea voyage, some people say at the age of 60, and it took him 3 years to get to southern China, hugging the coast. And sometimes we think of Bodhidharma as bringing Buddhism to China or bringing Zen to China, but that's really not true. In fact, Buddhism had already arrived in China, and there were several thousand monasteries at the time he arrived. And early Zen, which had begun developing in India, was there as well. The Prajñāparamita scriptures had arrived in the 2nd and 3rd centuries. So soon after his arrival, he headed north, and he traveled to northern China, and he had an encounter with Emperor Wu of the Liang dynasty in Nanking. And this may be the most famous story about Bodhidharma. You may have heard this a number of times. Emperor Wu was a follower of Buddhism, and he had had several monasteries built in his realm. And perhaps he had heard about this foreigner, and perhaps he had a sincere desire to learn from him. But it seems to me like what he was really looking for was some validation. Because his first question to Bodhidharma was, what merit have I accumulated for my future lives in building these monasteries? And Bodhidharma replied, no merit. Okay, so he's a little disappointed. No merit at all. So Wu comes back. What is the supreme meaning of the sacred truth? Vast emptiness. Nothing sacred. Not what Emperor Wu wants to hear. Then Wu asks, who is that stands before me? In other words, who are you? Bodhidharma replied, I don't know. So Emperor Wu has really struck out here. Three strikes and you're out. But I think this tells us a lot about Zen and how uncompromising it could be. I think Zen relentlessly rejects any attachment to any construct that takes us away from our immediate experience. You can't accumulate merit by doing good deeds. Life is not about building up a karmic bank account. Nothing builds up. We have this. We have this present moment. This is what we have continuously is this present moment. Things don't accumulate. And what is sacred? Nothing. Nothing is sacred in Zen. I mean, true, we have our altar here, and we have our sacred things on the altar. We have Manjushri and these other things. And the altar here is to remind us that these things are really important and wonderful and to really help us focus our attention. But what they're really saying is that these are examples of things in the world. Everything in the world is equally important, equally sacred, or perhaps not sacred at all. Because how can one thing be sacred to the detriment of another thing? We can't pick and choose. Then finally, in response to who are you, he says, I don't know. It's kind of a radical thing to say. And Emperor Wu didn't get it. He probably thought, well, this is a fool who stands before me. He doesn't even know who he is. But unlike in a lot of these stories, you know, in a lot of these stories, the student suddenly gets enlightened. Emperor Wu did not. He did not get it. But I don't know is really the highest wisdom in Zen. I don't know says, I'm open. I have no preconceptions. This is it. Hello. It just says, hello, hello. So Bodhidharma left Emperor Wu and he crossed the Yangtze River, and he did so while standing on a single blade of grass. And this is a famous scene in Chinese paintings, and it's usually portrayed as a single stalk of bamboo, and it's on the cover of the Red Pine book, and I know you can't see this from where you are, but he's just standing with some dignity holding his staff, standing on this single stalk of bamboo as if it were a large raft. And Andy Ferguson says that this scene says something about Zen. His escape from Emperor Wu, who doesn't properly understand Zen, evokes a feeling of inspired defiance and a rejection of the world's folly, and a crossing over to the other shore, which is a Buddhist metaphor for liberation. So he later arrived at Shaolin Temple, a famous temple, and one source says, he found the clergy at Shaolin Temple weak and prone to the depredations of local bandits. So he taught them exercises in self-defense, from which the famous Shaolin style of martial arts developed. So Bodhidharma was a busy guy. He brought martial arts to China. One source says there is no possibility that this could be true. But it shows some toughness. It shows some toughness in Zen, even a potential for violent confrontation wrapped up with the Bodhisattva story. So there's kind of a theme developing here. Zen is tough stuff in Bodhidharma's world. And then, speaking of being tough, he found a cave and he took up residence there and he sat facing a wall and he stayed there for 9 years. 9 years facing the wall. And he sat there so long that his legs withered away. That's the story. And that is the origin of the Daruma doll, which can be found all over Japan. And these dolls, it's a Bodhidharma doll, and I have a couple of examples here. They're sometimes weighted, so you can push them over and they come back. A nice symbol of resilience. And I have these examples here, they're not weighted, but they do not have legs, and they have that kind of rounded look. This one I like because it's really cute. It is the opposite of the tough Bodhidharma. It's really cutified. And there's one here which is an incense burner where he looks really mean, and another little red one that Bouchot brought me from the Tokyo airport that also looks really mean. So at one point during those 9 years, he became very drowsy, and he was enraged by his drowsiness. And, okay, here's where the story starts to get a little grotesque. He tore off his own eyelids so he would not be able to sleep, and that's why he has bulging eyes. He has no eyelids. That's why he's always portrayed that way. And then he threw his eyelids on the ground, and tree plants grew there, and that was the beginning of tea in China. That's our guy. He brought tea to China. We have some lineage. And then it gets, there's one more incident which is even worse. There, depending on your point of view, yes, there was a student named Hui Ko who wanted to study with Bodhidharma. And there are a lot of versions of this story. In the most popular one, it's set forth in Red Pine's Zen Baggage, is that Hui Ko came to Bodhidharma's cave, wanted to be a student. Bodhidharma would not pay any attention to him. So he just stood there for several days. It snowed, and he stood there in the snow. Finally, Hui Ko was so desperate, he took an implement of some kind, and he began cutting on his left arm, and he cut off his left forearm. And he brought it to Bodhidharma, presented him his left forearm as an offering. You can see paintings of this. And at that point, Bodhidharma asked, "What do you want?" Hueco said, "I can't keep my mind still. I need your help." Bodhidharma, "Show me your mind that you can't keep still." Hueco, "I've tried everything and I can't get hold of it." Bodhidharma, "Then you've already stilled it." And at that moment, Hueco learned the true nature of mind and became Bodhidharma's student. So it's wonderful that he had this enlightenment experience, but it would have been really nice if he didn't have to maim himself before that dialogue took place. And of course, this story seems utterly fantastical. It's really hard to believe it happened. And yet, Dumoulin, well-known, respected scholar, says in a footnote that scholars who dismiss this story have obviously been unable to imagine the seriousness with which disciples longed for the Dharma in those days. So he thinks it may have really happened. Maybe it did. Whether it did probably doesn't matter so much, but the fact that it's been preserved as a story is interesting. And the question is, why have these stories grown up and persisted? For some good reasons and maybe not so good reasons. One maybe not so good reason is that to some extent they've been promoted to glorify Zen. He brought tea to China. He brought martial arts to China. He's also said to have lived to the age of 150. And there's even a story where he, in effect, rose from the dead. So maybe competitive monks promoted these stories to show that their lineage was the really good one. And maybe, with very good intention, people repeated these stories because they thought, because they were really fierce, they would encourage people to practice really hard. This is how much you should love the Dharma. And, I think you should practice hard, and I love the Dharma. But this approach kind of bothers me. And I think that these kinds of stories can easily be used to encourage what I would call macho Zen, which is not something I'm fond of and is not something that I would like to encourage. And I don't think it's something we really see a lot of here. I think, but it does exist, and it certainly has existed historically. And if we're going to see Bodhidharma as a role model, we've got that scowl and the eyes, and we have the stories which tell us pursue enlightenment at the expense of everything else, even to the extent of destroying your own body. Now, it's true that I think kind of a fierce devotion to our own practice is needed if we're going to break through. And there were the austerities of the Buddha. He starved himself. It almost killed him. That led to his enlightenment, and people respect that struggle. But we also need to remember that it was only when he rejected those austerities and decided to take solid food and take care of his own body that he became enlightened. That really, really harsh path was really the wrong path for him. And he adopted the middle way, which rejects these really extreme forms of practice. So I'm not saying we shouldn't engage in deep, challenging practice. I think perhaps these extreme stories can even be helpful if we take them kind of as symbols for a great devotion to practice. But I feel that the practice, if you do it sincerely, is hard enough. We don't have to add to it by being harsh with one another. Let's present it in a nurturing context, not a tough or a mean context. And to me, the symbolism of cutting off one's arm is really contrary to the spirit of Zen. We don't cut things off. We don't isolate things. We don't divide up the world. We heal the world. We bring things together. We join together with things. We don't hurt human beings, and that means we don't hurt ourselves either. And we have to keep in mind that some of the fiercer forms in our tradition, Japanese Soto Zen, were developed in the context of teaching young male monks, and it's a real boot camp approach. But here, in this country, in the present day, we are teaching folks of all ages. We have men and women practicing together, thank God, so to speak. And we don't live in monasteries. And so a gentler approach is needed, I think. I still want 7 days of Rohatsu. I still want Oryoki. I love those challenges. But I think we need to look at alternative things, too, because not everybody is able to do 7 days of Rohatsu. Maybe you can do it sometimes, another time you can't. I think we need to learn to be a little more accommodating. And I'd like to contrast Hui Ko's story with another story, which also involves extreme spiritual longing. And this is from a talk given at Green Gulch by Ajahn Linda Ruth Cutts a few years ago. She's from the San Francisco Zen Center. It's from a book called Seeds of Virtue, Seeds of Change. And she tells the story of Ananda and Kashyapa. So Ananda was the Buddha's faithful attendant for years and years. Took good care of the Buddha, could remember every word the Buddha ever said and recite it, but he did not become enlightened during the Buddha's lifetime. I think he was too busy looking after the Buddha. Kashyapa became enlightened. He was the one guy who got it that time when Buddha held up a flower. And Kashyapa, or Maha Kashyapa, became the Buddha's successor. And Ananda really, really wanted enlightenment. And they were out one day walking, and Ananda said to Kashyapa, "What did the Buddha transmit to you besides the golden-sleeved robe?" So he's kind of desperate. He's like, "Did the Buddha give you something besides his robe? What is it? Can you tell me what it is? Can I have it, please? Can you tell me what enlightenment is?" And Kashyapa's response is to say, "Ananda." And Ananda's response is to say, "Yes." And Kashyapa said, "Take down that banner pole at the gate." And Ananda was greatly enlightened. And I think taking down that banner pole has something to do with desire and asserting your own needs. But there's a lot we could talk about with this story, but what I want to focus on is what Linda Cutts focuses on, which is the Ananda and the yes. Ananda is making this desperate plea to Kashyapa. Kashyapa says Ananda. Ananda replies yes. The two of them together, she says, were just one call and response. He called Ananda's name, and Ananda immediately responded without thinking. He didn't think, "Gee, how come he's calling me?" He just said yes. It was immediate. It was automatic. This is deep, deep compassion. Kashyapa just cut through what Ananda was fishing for. "Ananda, yes, it's enough. There's nothing you're lacking, Ananda. You are abundantly filled with the Dharma." And Ananda's yes expressed that completely. There's nothing lacking. There is a call, and you are respond, and you respond. You are complete. You don't have to change yourself. You don't have to cut off your arm. Everything is okay. And that, I think, is a better model of practice. Teacher and student are directly connecting. They're doing the dance. It's mutually supportive. It's a kinder, gentler model of Zen. No one gets hurt. And Linda Cutt says, "Call and response is the name of infinite compassion." She notes that Ananda's name means joy, and that we can't be joyful if we don't get some rest. Taking repose and rest are essential for joy. Ease and repose, ease and repose. If you're going to enter the Dharma gate, you can't always be seeking. You can't always be in this desperate state. There's a kind of relaxation that comes. And these harsh forms can prevent us from ever getting to that relaxation, that aware relaxation, that ease and repose. So I think if we take the middle way here, we can look at our Zen tradition with a kind but skeptical eye. And I think we can recognize that there are some fierce elements to this tradition that are maybe not so helpful. But we can also recognize that the stories surrounding Bodhidharma and some of the other ancestors are really useful for pointing us to the heart of Zen, even though they may have some troublesome aspects. De Moulin says, we can extrapolate from Bodhidharma's image the inner content of the way to enlightenment. Maybe if we soften it a little bit, maybe if we're a little more like this cutified Bodhidharma. Well, I don't want to cutify the practice too much, but so these stories about Bodhidharma, there is no merit, nothing is holy, crossing the river on a blade of grass, martial arts, facing the wall for 9 years, the eyelids, the left arm, they're all meant to shake you up. They're all meant to really, really challenge you and say, it's right here, it's this moment, direct experience, that's the heart of Zen. It's not what you think it is. Whatever you think it is, that is not it. And here's a harsh image to shake you out of that. And perhaps we can take in that part while still being a little critical of the harshness. Perhaps we can see what's valuable while placing it in the context of the time when it occurred, which was in this all-male setting in a very different time and place. So at the end here, I would just like to repeat the four-line poem, a special transmission outside the teachings, not relying upon words and letters, pointing directly at the human mind, seeing one's own nature and becoming a Buddha. So forget words and letters. Forget my words this morning. See your own nature. You won't see your own nature by reading books. Again and again, that's what the ancestors bring us to. And I'm glad you came this morning. I'm glad I've had a chance to talk to you. I hope it's helpful. But remember, words are not enough. We need to nurture our sitting practice. We need to nurture our mindfulness practice and see our own nature. And that's what I have to say about Bodhidharma. And we have a little time left, so if anyone has a comment or a question, I would be happy to hear from you. Yes, Dennis.
I'm definitely not a Zen scholar. And I know we're not supposed to be concentrating on the words and letters, but some of the words are bothering me.
Mm-hmm.
So in the poem, he uses the term become a Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
Although what I have studied and learned since I've been a member here is that the Buddha already resides, and it's more of just a instance of becoming aware, if you will. So are the words just words, or is there somewhere between that time and this time that the thought and awareness of your real Buddha nature, was there a shift?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I had exactly the same thought. Becoming a Buddha suggests we are not Buddha now. And I think perhaps seeing one's own nature and uncovering a Buddha might be better. We're a Buddha, but we don't know it because it gets obscured. Might be better. And I don't know, you know, it'd be really interesting to look at some other translations and to see if this becoming a Buddha might be something that's translated differently other places, or whether Bodhidharma had this idea that we're not Buddhas now, but we can become Buddhas. I don't know. But certainly I think later Zen, it would be out of step with the idea that we're not a Buddha and we can become a Buddha. Yeah.
Or maybe we're just not supposed to be tied up with the words and letters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, we're not supposed to be tied up with them. But and although I keep dissing words and letters, you know, study is helpful because it helps to point us to that direct experience. We just cannot confuse the study with the thing it's pointing to. you know, the study is not the end. So, thank you. Thanks for the comment. Yes, Taras.
I had a question. I guess this isn't really super related to the talk, but I liked your talk. But like, I was just sort of randomly thinking about Mara, who used to mess with Buddha, right?
Yes.
You know, he summons like the army of demons to shoot arrows at him, and Buddha turns into flowers. And then there's the other story where Mara visits him in the cave, and they hang out. And I guess my question is like, what's sort of the role of Mara in the mythology as far as after that like cave incident, did Buddha and after like Buddha becomes enlightened, did they sort of like make up? Are they is Mara like just the symbolism of Buddha's problems, and like once he had sort of became enlightened, you know, he sort of goes away?
Mm-hmm. I think a key thing about this is I believe he did invite Mara to tea, and you mentioned that. And I think that's really the key, that Mara is something that is in all of us, and we don't make it the other. It's something that we all need to get to know and work with. So we sort of posit this Mara who's separate from us, you know, this sort of temptation, all this bad stuff, which can be useful for us in some ways, but ultimately we have to recognize that these difficult aspects of human nature are not something that we can really totally transcend and get rid of, but they're things we need to come to terms with. Does that kind of get at what you're talking about? Okay, thank you. Carrie?
When I think about the cutting off the arm and talk about the symbolism, mm-hmm. it seems to me that these kind of stories are symbolic for, like you said, I mean, kind of the suffering that we're going through until we, you know, become enlightened or have a moment of awareness that, you know, that we may be cutting ourselves off from other experience.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's symbolic of that, how he was actually so, you know, stuck in suffering that, you know, that, I don't know.
Sure.
Thinking of it that way.
Yeah. So if you look at it that way, he's not someone to emulate. He's someone to, you know, feel compassion for because he's so desperate.
Right, and a symbol that we all, you know, we all are there. Like, we all are that suffering being that it's, you know, that even though we're not cutting mm-hmm. our arm, we are doing things that are, as you know, putting us in that place of suffering.
Right, hurting ourselves. Yeah.
Hurting ourselves is
sure.
Makes us not look like cutting, maiming ourselves. But how are we, you know, how are we symbolically maiming ourselves with our thoughts, with our actions, with our...
Yeah. Like every violent thought against ourselves. Yeah, and lack of self-forgiveness. Yeah, I like that interpretation. Yes, Lena.
Yeah, I had a similar reaction of Carrie, thinking of the... my physical experience can get really uncomfortable in meditation when you feel like burning sensations in the body. My legs don't physically fall off. there's sometimes some very intense physical sensations
mm-hmm.
through the practice and through things coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And that can live in the body. And so, I don't know, that's kind of what came to my mind of the symbolism of the falling off, or the eyelids, or the hand. It's just
mm-hmm.
stuff we go through physically to get to recover the Buddha. And I wondered if you could speak to that of, like, we took those stories as metaphors or symbols for some intense physical discomfort that come up in the practice. What, how then do we work with
that? Yeah. How do we work with that? Yeah. I think as to how that relates to Bodhidharma's story, I think you said that pretty well. I think with how do we work with those intense pains, intense difficulties, I think we find the middle way, that we do not always just tough everything out. You know, we don't sit so long that we damage our knees or something like that. We move to a chair when we need to. And if we're having intense issues, inner stuff, facing our dragons, well, maybe we need to face our dragons, but maybe not today. You know, we need to do that in a way that is not going to harm us. So we need to be gentle about that. We need to be, you know, prepared. We need to have proper support. I guess one of my, you know, fears about what I'm calling Macho Zen is that it would be an attempt to drive people to the point where, you know, they hurt themselves and don't do this in a healthy way. We have to be able to sustain this practice over a long period of time. So we need to follow our own instincts about how to do it in a healthy way. Yeah, do you have anything to add? Okay, thank you. Yes, Jeffrey.
Thank you for your talk.
Mm-hmm.
I'm bringing up the same problem I always have at a certain point in Dharma talks. Like many people, I started Zen practice because I was in pain in my personal life. And these stories helped me carry on the practice, sit through sesshins, a variety of things like that. But at some point, what this practice did for me, not the stories, but the fact that I was sitting, it just kind of opened my mind to the reality of this moment and what a deep and sacred puzzle it is that we are conscious. And our conscious and discursive mind can't figure out why we are conscious. There's no explanation for it. None. You know, brain dead zombies, we could explain that, right? Machines, matter, all that kind of stuff. But in fact, our consciousness is rooted in our bodies. Our bodies are, you're drinking water, are part of this earth. They're not separate from it. But we have this crazy idea that our individual selves are separate from the world we live in. What our conscious mind is good for is developing ideas about what is surrounding us and telling us some of the things about how to proceed. And in particular, for me, the thing that stands out is the fact that humanity is in crisis at this point. It is in crisis precisely because we don't understand that we are the earth. And so instead, we, which is to say our ancestors, have created this world which is based on slavery, on genocide against Native Americans, on attacks, on, and speaking about the U.S. in particular, which was one of the main forces. So what do? Because this machine that we've created is now destroying our environment and all of us. So somehow or another, I'm trying to figure out how to maintain this view of the sacredness of this moment and this enormous problem, because we need our conscious mind in order to help us through this process. But it's not the answer. The two of them together are essential. Sorry, that was long-winded.
That was beautifully said, and I agree, and those are, yeah, that's where we have to go. All right. Thank you.